Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to the best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. The following program today was originally broadcast on the 7th of April, 2012, and is presented by Paulette McQuarrie.
On March 15th, Beijing's top party chief in the city of Zhongqing was fired. Bo Xilai was seen by many as the golden boy of the Communist Party and someone who could have been picked as the party's future. But this didn't happen. Just before he was fired, his chief of police was trying to seek refuge at the American consulate. A British businessman with ties to MI6 and part of Xilai's inner circle was found dead in a hotel in Chongqing. Authorities reported that he died from consuming too much alcohol, but an autopsy was never done and his body was cremated. So with all these twists and turns and lack of information from Beijing, it sparked a flurry of speculation online within China. On March 31st, Beijing shut down 16 microblogs and arrested 6 people for spreading rumors of a power struggle and coup within the Communist Party. Keith joins us now for more.
Bo Xilai, for those who don't know, was the head Communist Party chief for the city of Chongqing, which is one of the most vibrant cities in China. This story has so many twists and turns. It's like a never-ending mystery novel. So many things have been happening with this case. It changes every day. And what happened was, because the government really didn't say anything to begin with, or what was really going on, they shut down these blogs because all of a sudden rumors started to appear.
So censors apparently then have been having trouble keeping up with this. And so how have they been censoring it, and how are the people getting around the censors?
Well, basically what happens, if you go to any of the microblogs in China and post something about Bo Xilai, it'll be taken down immediately. Or if you do a search on any of the search engines in China for Bo Xilai, you'll just get a message saying, oh, we can't find any information. But people are very savvy. So for Bo Xilai, for example, they'll come up with another name like, something like, say, the duck that got lost or something, a translation in Chinese, right? Mm-hmm. And then people know, oh, that's what it refers to. So then they can search and then they can post things. But it takes a while for the censors to catch up with this, to find out what the secret names are for everybody involved in this story. I mean, this whole story involves, listen to this, it involves a British businessman who was found dead in a hotel room, who had connections with MI6. It involves the former chief of police for Chongqing seeking refuge in the American consulate in the city. And then when he left the consulate, he disappeared. It involved pressure against so many people who just disappeared or refused then to have any knowledge of what Bo Xilai was up to.
So since the government then is cracking down on providers now, because this is just like in the old Cold War days when people talked in code, right, amongst themselves because they were looking over their shoulder to see if there was some Communist Party member going to take them and send them off to a gulag or whatever the Chinese equivalent was. So that's the situation now with the censors. So they're having trouble keeping up. So the government then has to crack down on the providers, right? And how are they... How are they doing that? What are the curbs that they're bringing in?
Well, what they're doing, for example, if you or I sign up to a social media site, we can sign up and we don't have to, let's say, give our social insurance number or passport number. The new regulations in place now in China, if you sign up with one of these blogs, first you have to sign up with your own name and then you have to use your ID number, your actual ID number. And the system is set up so even if you enter a fake ID number, it won't let you join. You have to enter the real ID number. So this is what they're doing. And they've been doing this now more so in the past year because Beijing is really tense about the situation in the Middle East because we've seen how it's been playing out. People are getting information from Twitter. They're getting information from Facebook and other social media sites. So when it comes to social media sites now in China, they're really nervous.
Well, so rumors have been spreading about there being a coup in Beijing. They were actually using that word. But on the other hand, there were reports that it was just talk and it was actually the whole idea was far-fetched. But is the Chinese government so threatened, they're so insecure in their leadership and their grip on power and controlling the society that they're really worried about this and they're willing to take these expensive, drastic measures, tying up civil servants and stifling commercial enterprise to keep a lid on it?
Well, you see, this is the situation in China. China has a lot of cracks in the system. In the past few years, there have been more and more protests taking place in the countryside. Some of them are, of course, legitimate reasons to protest. Others are because of rumors that started. Now, the rumors start only because Beijing keeps a tight lip about things. So because they're not saying anything, it makes people wonder, well, why are they being so quiet about it? What are they trying to hide? And then, of course, maybe somebody mentions, oh, there's a possible coup. And it's like the old game of broken telephone. Right. Maybe you mention possible coup, and then maybe, you know, 100,000 people down the line, you know, who are reading this and commenting, all of a sudden it turns into a coup. And then it turns into tanks, you know, going into Beijing. So, you know, part of the problem is that because Beijing didn't say anything to begin with, these rumors just started.
So they create their own problem, in other words.
Exactly. They created their own problem. If they'd come forward to begin with and say, well, Bo Xilai did this, that, and the other, this is what we're doing, maybe then it would have been handled differently. Now, I don't want to give too many specifics around this case because it's forever changing. And by the time this program airs, probably some information that I would give out right now would be out of date. So I don't want to give too many specifics about the case. But like I said, it is a real mystery.
And we'll have more for you as this story develops. You're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. Longwave is a part of the spectrum that many people are not familiar with. Kevin Carey is the author of Listening to Longwave, The World Below 500 Kilohertz. So just what can you tune into and what can you hear? We contacted Kevin for more information about Longwave and what you can listen to.
Longwave really refers to the lower reaches of the radio spectrum. There's an inverse relationship to frequency and wavelength. So we have these very low or small frequencies, say 100 kilohertz, but it's a very long wavelength in terms of the sine wave being emitted by the antenna. So they're referred to as long waves, which is really a relative term. I mean, we have the medium wave, the AM broadcast band, but you do rarely hear of long wave outside of Europe and parts of Asia, where actually it's been very popular for broadcasting for a number of years.
Has long wave ever been used in the United States for broadcasting?
Well, not for broadcasting, and that's an interesting topic. I recently had a reader from my Monitoring Times column ask that question. And the only thing that I can really figure is that the band was used early on for aviation or navigation application, beacons, non-directional beacons. Some of these came on the air as early as the late 1920s, and that's really when broadcasting was taking off, at least here in the U.S., and so since the band was already in heavy use and growing use for long-wave beacons, I think that kind of precluded having broadcast stations on there. That's my theory, but I'm certainly open to any other inputs that folks might have.
What are some of the advantages and disadvantages by using long-wave as a means of transmission? Now, when I was living in Europe, BBC Radio 4, you can pick up in most European countries. The same thing with Deutschlandfunk and some of the long-wave broadcasters out of Russia. There was certainly no problem picking them up.
Yes. One of the key benefits is the propagation. And as you noted, some of these stations can be heard over a very wide area, four or five countries or more. It's not unusual. And long-wave has ground-hugging characteristics. By that, I mean the skip zone, the skip mode of operation is not very prominent, especially when you get down in the lower reaches, 180 to, say, 300 kilohertz. There's not a lot of escape happening, but yet the signal will go long ranges, even during the daytime, over ground wave propagation. So that's a key benefit. The con side to it is the size of the antennas needed. They're humongous. I talked earlier about the long wavelengths involved on these frequencies. Well, that necessitates a very large antenna, at least if you're going to be transmitting. So very large antenna arrays, a lot of high-power installations, but the coverage really balances that out.
So if you take, let's say, your average shortwave station that would use maybe 100 or 250 kilowatts to cover a very wide area, would you use the same power with long wave?
Well, you could, and I'm sure that there are some lower-powered long wave stations that might be in that range. But I hear frequently of broadcast stations on long wave who are using a megawatt or more of power. So that's not uncommon.
Your book, Listening to Long Wave, The World Below 500 Kilohertz, what do you mainly focus on in the book for somebody that doesn't know? Now, I read the book, but I want people to go out and get the book, so I don't want to say too much about it.
Appreciate that. Well, the book really is an introductory coverage of long wave. I tried to make it as broad-based as possible. We want to have folks read the book who might only know the name long wave, and they're just curious about what goes on there, what types of stations use the band, what's involved with setting up a receiving station, how do I improve reception. All of these sorts of things are covered. We go into some of the special users of the band, like the so-called loafers or low-frequency experimental radio stations. We cover, of course, the non-directional beacons that are on there, some of the weather broadcasts and foreign broadcasts that can be heard from overseas. So there's quite a bit of coverage there, and my goal really was to range it from the very beginning listener to someone who's already involved in long wave and just wants a handy reference to see what's new on the band, maybe since they were active. This actually was a revision of an earlier book that was done, back in the 80s. And there had been so much change in the band, new users, some countries allowing amateur radio operations, things of that sort. So it was really time to refresh the book and bring it up to date.
How did you get interested in long wave? Because, a lot of modern receivers don't have long wave. I know there's listeners right now probably living in the United States and Canada that say, oh, I remember an old Grundig or Telefunken radio my parents bought from Germany had long wave on it. But how did you get interested in it? Because most shortwave radios that you can find today don't have the long wave bands.
Oh, that's a great question. I guess as I think back on my interest in the radio hobby in general, I've always been drawn to underdog things. tell me that I can't do something, and I'm going to try to find a way to do it. So, you know, long wave. I first read about it in the ARRL operating guide from the mid-1970s, and it covered every ham band one by one with different headings from 160 meters right up to 10 meters. And then it had this side note that there's this experimenter's band at 160 to 190 kilohertz, and it talked about how equipment had to be home-brewed because there were very few, if any, commercial sources for this type of equipment. The operating conditions were very challenging, a maximum 50-foot antenna and 1 watt of power. So I looked at that side note about this band, and they made the point it was not a ham band per se, but available for experimentation. And from there, I started exploring more and more. And then I saw a circuit for a receiving converter in 73 magazine, which was written by Ken Cornell, who is now a silent key, unfortunately, but he lived in New Jersey, and he was known as the Long Wave Wizard. He promoted this experimental band back in the early 1970s when hardly anyone here was using it, and most people weren't even aware of it. But anyway, he had this conversion circuit, which allowed you to listen to that range and other long wave frequencies, just using an 80-meter handband receiver. And I built the circuit up. I still have it, in fact. And that kind of got me started. And when I tuned into these beacons, I wanted to learn more about them, of course, and got involved with the Long Wave Club of America, the LWCA, which is still active today. And it kind of blossomed from there.
At this very moment, if you turn on your long wave receiver, what can you hear where you are?
Well, being daylight right now, we're 12:30 p.m. local time, I would expect to hear mainly non-directional beacons, or NDBs. These are 25 to 50 watt, typically, operating stations for the benefit of aircraft, for homing applications. Our area here has five or six of them around, say within 60 miles of my location, so I would expect to hear those. A little higher up in the band, I would probably expect to hear the Navtex transmissions, which are teleprinter-like traffic sources that are used for weather conditions and maritime notices and things like that. So those would be the main things. I would not expect to hear any broadcasters at this time of the day. You really need a path of darkness between here and, say, Europe to have a shot at hearing them.
But can you hear the broadcasters from Europe?
Oh, yes. It's not what I would call armchair copy. I have a pretty good assortment of antennas here, directional loop, an active antenna that's specifically for long wave. And since I'm in a fairly rural location, yes, I would expect to hear five or six of them. And it would be a bit of a struggle, perhaps, to pull out what was actually being said. You would certainly recognize songs if they were playing music. I once heard a cricket game being broadcast, which was kind of interesting because there was a stateside beacon in the background keying away, and I'm hearing these results for a cricket game.
The book is called Listening to Long Wave, The World Below 500 Kilohertz. The author, Kevin Clary, is joining us. Kevin, if somebody wants to get the book, what's the easiest way?
Well, the book is offered by Universal Radio. Universal was my publisher on the project, and they are located in Reynoldsburg, Ohio. And for anyone who wishes to check it out on the web, they can go to universal-radio.com, universal and then a dash radio.com, and look under the books section of their offerings, and you'll get complete information.
Kevin, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Been my pleasure, Keith. A lot of fun.
For more information on how to order a copy of Kevin's book, go to www.universal-radio.com.
That was an edition of Media Network Plus that was broadcast on the 7th of April, 2012. Facebook, in a protracted battle to keep its users safe from abuse, says it is investigating the case of a Samoan woman who claims she received death threats on the platform. Samoan Arthur Lanny Vent Young says her abusers have been able to act with impunity, and Amnesty International is urging New Zealand to amend its laws to combat the social media giant. Mackenzie Smith reports.
For writer Lani Went Young, online abuse on Facebook has happened daily.
One man in particular was quite upset with me, writing to tell me that he was going to chop me up and drag my carcass behind his truck, cook me in omu.
She says regular abuse first started 2 years ago when she used her blog to speak out against laws in Samoa preventing gay parents from blessing their children. The former Auckland resident regularly writes on contentious issues in conservative Samoa, including speaking out against child sexual abuse and in defence of LGBT rights. In January, she had a new abuser, a notorious but anonymous Samoan blog, which Ms Young says is run by multiple people. With the blog's fans in tow, the stream of abuse became a torrent.
People saying that, you know, I need to be put in jail, and people stick things in my mouth and, you know, other places to make me be quiet.
But when Miss Young reported the comments and messages to Facebook, she says they rarely took content down, complicated by the fact a lot of it is in Nanana Samoa.
It's just been such a frustration trying to you know, to report things to Facebook and to constantly have them coming back and saying, this does not reach our community standards. It's horrible. And, you know, every day you log on and you're afraid to log on because of, you know, new stuff that might be there.
She says New Zealand police also turned her away, saying there was nothing they could do. She has since shut down her Facebook account, but abuse continues to trickle to her through other inlets like her husband's Facebook account. Amnesty International research recently found almost a third of women in New Zealand reported abuse and harassment in online spaces. The figures are even worse for women who are Pacific, Māori, LGBT or part of other minority groups.
What we've seen here in New Zealand and overseas is that women of colour tend to get a unique and sometimes increased level of abuse online.
Amnesty International NZ's campaigns director, Meg Durand, is pushing for an overhaul of New Zealand's Digital Communications Act to improve protections for women. She says the prevalence of Facebook and Twitter has worsened conditions for women facing abuse, with little oversight from the social media giants.
Often you'll hear of people reporting abuse, and then it's not removed when it should be. Or you'll hear of people reporting abuse, and then that person's just able to open their account within another week.
A spokesperson for Facebook says the safety of its community is its top priority.
We want people to be able to express themselves freely in a safe and secure environment. We're currently investigating comments directed at Lani and will take action on those found to be in violation of our community standards.
But based on her experiences, Ms. Young says Facebook is a big part of the problem when it comes to online enforcement.
They just don't seem to have any accountability. And I don't think that it's right that people can get away with things that they say and do on Facebook. And Facebook has a big part to play and they're not living up to it.
She says the abusive comments have restricted her and her family's freedom and made her question what she can do. This is Mackenzie Smith.
There is a new scheme to try to end the violence that has become part and parcel of accusations of sorcery in Papua New Guinea. Yumi is to be strong, which means let's stand alone strong together, is an initiative to tackle sorcery-related violence in PNG. Violent attacks, often resulting in death, have become more and more common in the island in recent years. But a Queensland University of Technology researcher has teamed up with PNG human rights activists to create short films with the aim of bringing the impact of sorcery-related violence to a wider audience. These digital stories aim to tackle the problem of violence connected with sorcery. Don Wiseman spoke with the university's Vera Thomas about the work.
So we were currently working with four community-based organizations in Papua New Guinea to develop materials and do that collectively. So we have done this in particular through the development of digital stories. We've created together 40 digital stories. These are individual stories and experiences of human rights defenders who have taken photographs and recorded their own stories that really deal with the causes, the impacts, but also the solutions to sorcery accusation-related violence. So the project has a research component to better understand the different manifestations of sorcery accusation-related violence. It has an advocacy component to develop these materials, to then take them out to communities and others. And this component is in line with the Sorcery National Action Plan to address this issue in Papua New Guinea.
We know that there have been some very, very terrible cases of people being accused of sorcery in Papua New Guinea over the last few years. So some of these first-hand accounts from human rights workers, they must be pretty graphic.
Of course, the experiences of the human rights defenders are very intense, and the impacts in the communities as well. However, when we look at the way we are creating advocacy materials and we want to represent the issue in the media, we really want to focus on some of the solutions and some of the stories that are coming out. But when we represent them, for example, in the digital stories, we do not focus on graphic imagery like we have seen in some of the media accounts. We are more looking at the use of metaphors, storytelling, and other ideas to visually represent stories in a respectful way, but also in a way that we can touch people in terms of understanding impact of the issue. So we are actually looking for a response that creates empathy in the community and gets people to experience more the emotional side of what people have gone through and to understand that this is an impact to the community as a whole. And so we have started these processes now with communities through screenings of these digital stories. And we're finding that it is creating a platform for these conversations. Say, instead of presenting these horrific and graphic images, we're trying to actually looking with the community at the different solutions that they can develop together with the community-based organizations and the human rights defenders.
Are you going to people and essentially saying to them that, look, you've got some wrong-headed ideas about sorcery, or is it more nuanced than that?
Yes, I think that where we distinguish very clearly is we are not saying that people don't have the right to believe. We understand that human rights, you know, individuals have a right to believe, but we distinguish between using a belief to harm another person or to justify violence. So that's a very clear message that the human rights defenders carry, to say that the law is very clear in Papua New Guinea and worldwide that you cannot use your belief to harm another person. And we're trying to bring this information also about the law to the communities. But we are doing it in a way where we're sharing the stories of the human rights defenders in the first place to say, look at these stories and the impact that this has had on communities and individuals, and reflect on your own community what is happening here. So it is a way to start this conversation in the community, and not to talk at people, but to invite them to have conversations around it, invite these reflections within communities.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to get in touch with us to let us know if there's a program that you would like to hear again, please do so. Our email address, pcjmedia@gmail.com. And do let us know how you heard the program, if it was through the World Radio Network or on shortwave or through one of our many partner stations. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care, 73 and 88. To the ladies.
Yeah.